Welcome to The Human Advantage, a podcast from the Center for Army Leadership, which explores the more personal and tactical applications of leadership. In each episode, we meet someone who's experienced the highs and lows of leading in situations ranging from major combat operations to challenges in barracks. We explore what they've learned about leadership to help our junior leaders prepare for success on operations today and in the future. I'm your host, Ash Bardwaj, a journalist and broadcaster and a British Army Reserve captain with the Rifles. In this episode, we learn how self-leadership will impact how others perceive us and affect our own competency.
How you present yourself, you know, your punctuality, your turnout, all those little things connote reliability and professionalism. There can be a tendency to assume that because other nations' standards might not be as high as your own, you can afford to drop yours, and then you're in a race to the bottom.
And how personnel management forms a larger part of leadership than you might expect.
I've certainly written more soldiers' appraisals than I've been in contacts, and I've dealt with, you know, discipline, medical, all those sort of things in much greater measure than I ever have on exercise or operations. I think that's really important, and it goes back to this idea of getting to know people and trying to understand what makes them tick.
Lieutenant Colonel Ed Fraser commissioned in 2001 into the 1st Battalion, the King's Regiment, which was later amalgamated into the Duke of Lancaster's Regiment. He served on operations in Afghanistan on Op Herrick and twice in Iraq on Op Telik. Away from regimental duty, he instructed as a platoon commander at the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst. He was a staff officer in Army Headquarters Operational Training and Advisory Group and served as a military assistant to the commanding general, US Army Europe. He also led a mission support team for the African Union mission in Somalia on Op Tangam. He attended the Advanced Staff and Command course before taking up command of the 4th Battalion, the Duke of Lancaster's Regiment, during which he was commanded on Op Interflex. 5 years before commissioning, Colonel Ed actually did a one-year short service limited commission with the King's Regiment. I started by asking him why he chose to take that route.
I used that not in the way it was intended. I used that as a toe in the water to see whether the army was really for me on a kind of no commitment basis. I think as a teenager in my early 20s, the idea of doing a three-year short service commission seemed a little bit intimidating. So the idea of not biting off more than I could chew and seeing if I liked it was a tempting one. And I did, and I went back. And I think my minimum return of service would have got me to August 2004, and it's now February 2024. So I think I've exceeded that by a little margin. I think, you know, reflecting on how that then transformed my leadership, I arrived in my battalion in November 1996 as a very naive teenager with the thinnest veneer of military training. So I learned very much on the job as a leader, but I was privileged to be very closely mentored throughout that. So my platoon sergeant at the time became a lifelong friend. And I think the nature of the regimental system meant that the company second in command, the company commander, mentored me throughout the remainder of my junior career. So I made a lot of mistakes, but I think the environment at the time, I spent 12 months in Cyprus, which was comparatively benign at the time, that allowed me to make plenty of mistakes, to learn on the job and to have an apprenticeship in leadership. And through that, that helped me learn what, in my mind, what made our soldiers tick. Fast forward then through an undergraduate degree, through the Sandhurst full commissioning course, the platoon commander's battle course and the armored infantry platoon commander's course. I think by the time I'd got through all of that, I'd achieved the professional competencies that I really needed to be an effective armored infantry platoon commander. And I think that could only advantage me because I then had the depth of professional competence, but also I still had all of those personal engagements, relationships that I'd learned over the preceding 4+ years that allowed me to blend those two things effectively.
In the army, we often divide what business calls leadership up into three components: commander, leadership, and management. How do you think you developed the leadership aspect over those two different experiences? And when you became a more senior officer and looked at young officers coming through who'd only done the regular commissioning course at Sandhurst, the full-length one, compared to your experience, what do you think were the differences in leadership that that almost apprenticeship leadership gave you?
I think the apprenticeship in leadership gave me an opportunity to be really closely engaged with the Kingsmen that I led on a daily basis. And in doing so, I think it allowed me to develop a style that could be directive when it needed to be, but could be collegiate when it needed to be. And I think that was really helpful. And I would contrast that with the 44 weeks of the commissioning course, where for lots of people, the only time they get to practice leading people is when they're leading their peers, their friends in their platoon. And it can become a little bit of a stately dance as you're trying not to fall out with your friends, but you're still having to show enough directness and enough grip in order to achieve the task and get the tick in the box from your platoon commander or your platoon colour sergeant. And I think I saw that. I came back to Sandhurst as a platoon commander and did 12 months instructing on the commissioning course. And then a couple of years after that, I was then commanding a company in our 1st Battalion. And I saw young platoon commanders coming through who were sometimes a little bit diffident in their leadership, and they didn't really have the confidence to show the grip that was sometimes needed. I don't know whether I ever got that right, but I think I had more of an insight through my journey that allowed me to see how perhaps I should have been doing it, even if I didn't necessarily always model that behavior correctly myself.
So in terms of where the competency sits within that, it's setting the vision, but then also being very direct and clear about what you want. Is that the difference that you're talking about there?
I think it can be. And of course, this is a reflection on junior leadership, where it's quite often very direct. And I'm thinking about, you know, preparation for deploying as a company commander to Afghanistan, where, you know, we are dealing with critical activity, we are dealing with potentially life and death scenarios. And sometimes you can't be transformative, you can't be collegiate, it has to be you go there, do this now. And people understand that. But there's achieving that balance between using the right style of leadership. And I think it goes back to your comment about, is this command, is this leadership, is this management? And you've got to use the right set of tools for the circumstance.
And when you look back through your time as a leader, and particularly on operations, are there any specific examples of leadership style that you've picked up from individuals? Are there any anecdotes or examples of that?
I think one of the things that really struck me in company command is the power of complementary relationships and personalities. So as a company commander, I'm not a particularly demonstrative person. I know I'm also not a hugely charismatic person. And as a company commander, I got my head down. I tried to get the job done to the best of my ability, but not in a terribly demonstrative fashion. And my first company sergeant major was quite a similar personality to me. He was from Barrow-in-Furness on the west coast of Cumbria. He'd welded missile tubes in submarines before joining the army. And he was just this very level-headed, very steady influence. And he was great. And he was technically competent. He'd been a Sandhurst instructor, all those great things. But he and I sometimes were a bit too similar. My next company sergeant major was like a Springer Spaniel of a man. He was enthusiastic about everything. He bounded around the office, always at the top of his voice. And our Kingsmen absolutely loved him. And he had a charisma that I could not hope to match. And that was fine once I'd reconciled that. And I understood that the Kingsmen didn't need to hold me in the same regard that they held the Sergeant Major. It was enough that they held one of us in that regard. And if they would follow him everywhere, anywhere, that didn't really matter because he and I were shoulder to shoulder and the direction we were traveling in was the same.
And has that made you reflect on your own leadership styles and others' leadership styles, that there isn't necessarily a better style? So being more charismatic or being more level-headed and steady, neither is better, but it's just about developing leadership and working with your peers and subordinates to deliver the task and outcome?
I think that's right. It's about trying to use the right tools for the right job, and personality and character are a tool to achieve leadership in the same way that any other tool that we use would be.
When you promoted to Lieutenant Colonel, your first job wasn't becoming the commanding officer of the 4th Battalion, the Duke of Lancaster's regiment. You also spent time working to an American general in Europe. Can you talk to me about what that role involved and what it was like for you as reaching the rank of Lieutenant Colonel, but also working very much to somebody more senior than you?
So the job in what was then called US Army Europe was a fascinating one. I worked as an assistant to the commanding general, so an American lieutenant general, and I worked in what was called the Commander's Initiative Group. So we had free rein to author speeches, straw man papers, journal articles. We planned his travel and we supported his messaging in deriving the kind of talking points that he would use when engaging with military leaders or politicians or academics across the whole of Europe.
What did you learn about leadership from working to the Lieutenant General?
I had one occasion where I had to deliver some quite difficult news to him. He was very busy, 28 days of every month. He was probably on the road traveling across Europe and his time was very, very precious. So he would try to do a lot of business in transit if he could. And on this particular occasion, he was trying to get a German magazine journalist to travel with him on a US Army aircraft from point A to point B so he could get his messaging across. Unfortunately, the command's own lawyers determined that this wasn't an appropriate use of US taxpayers' money. And I had to break the news to the general. And the general had half promised a lift in his plane to this journalist, and he'd already planned out in his mind how it was going to be. And then I had to go in with the bad news. And I suppose the first point is bad news doesn't get better if you sit on it. You've just got to get in there straight away and take the pain. Unsurprisingly, the general lost his temper and I got told off in front of a fairly crowded office. And two things came out of that for me. The first is that by the time he had got home, the general had recovered his equilibrium and he had emailed me to apologize for the outburst. And in doing so, he recognized that he needed trusted people around him to give him bad news. He couldn't just be surrounded by yes men. And I think the other thing that was a nice touch is he didn't just send that to me. He sent that to everybody that could have been within earshot at the time in a fairly crowded open plan office. And for me, that was a generous thing to do. The other thing I reflected on that, this particular general at the time was responsible for more than 25,000 soldiers across the continent, a similar number of families and Department of the Army civil servants. For him, he had to be on top of his game and presenting the right public persona all day, every day. And I think as you become more senior as a leader and your day-to-day contact with your subordinates becomes less frequent, you've got to make sure that every interaction you have is a positive one that leads that subordinate to walk away thinking, yeah, the commanding officer or the brigadier or the general, you know, they've got my interests at heart. So it's got to be positive. And that means that a senior officer like that can't allow his temper to be shown in front of most people, but he's still got to be able to vent. And I think, therefore, that one of the leadership lessons I took from this was the idea that a leader has to have a safe way in which to vent and has to have trusted people sometimes around whom they can let their frustrations be felt. And for me, when that general was able to vent to me in that way, that told me that I had earned his trust.
And how have you found, now that you're in command yourself, you've dealt with the same things? How do you deal with venting?
I think I run on a fairly even keel, and I think I don't need to vent too often. But what I did do when I came in as a commanding officer, I kind of laid out a short note to the adjutant and a couple of other people to say, if you're managing me, these are the ways perhaps in which you want to think about managing me. Please be assured that it's not something to be taken personally, but it's something that I have to do so that then when I'm engaging with perhaps a reservist kingsman who might never get to speak to me again, I can do so in a positive way that makes that soldier feel as though they're a valued member of the organization, not that, oh, the commanding officer was distracted and clearly had something else on his mind and was just a bit hard to be around. Because I think, certainly for me, the dispersed nature of a reserve battalion, I've got 10 Army Reserve centers from Liverpool and Manchester in the south to Carlisle and Workington in the north means that I'm always going to be spread very, very thin. And I don't get the interaction with the nearly 400 men and women in the battalion as frequently as I would wish.
Throughout a lot of our training, whether that's skill training or time here at Sandhurst doing leadership training, we're often focused on operational planning and operational delivery. The elements of personal administration, G1 or J1 as it's known in terminology, is often missed as a skill to develop. How have you found, since becoming a commanding officer or as a company commander, that aspect of leadership mattering?
I spent most of my time on the commissioning course thinking about, you know, how I was going to succeed on operations and defeat the Queen's enemies. And I didn't spend an awful lot of time thinking about managing people, leading people. I've certainly written more soldiers' appraisals than I've been in contacts. And I've dealt with, you know, discipline, medical, all those sort of things in much greater measure than I ever have on exercise or operations. I think that's really important. And it goes back to this idea of the apprenticeship I served in leadership before my career really started and getting to know people and trying to understand what makes them tick. There's an aphorism that says that people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And that really came home to me in my first 12 months as a commanding officer. One of my senior NCOs was coming to the end of his regular service. He was a permanent staff instructor with the battalion, and he had a health scare. And it wasn't quite clear what this was, but there was a danger. It could have been cancer, and it could have been quite serious. And this was all coming at a really difficult point in this soldier's transition from regular service to reserve service. His resettlement training was being interrupted. He wasn't sure about what his source of income was going to be when he left regular service. There were just lots and lots of life stresses all adding up at the same time. And then this health worry on top of it. And with the advantage of having known this senior NCO for perhaps 20 years, I was able to sit down and have quite a difficult conversation with him. And I had to talk to him about how he was going to manage. But most importantly, I had to have that conversation about, well, what if this is cancer? What if this is terminal? How are you going to make sure your wife and your kids are looked after in the long term? And because I was the commanding officer, I think I could have that really difficult conversation. And it really reminded me that actually that was one of the responsibilities that came with it. The responsibility to have a really tough conversation with somebody and to tell them something they didn't necessarily want to hear, but they absolutely had to confront. And unsurprisingly, I got a significant emotional response from this soldier who was having this conversation. But at the same time, I was then able also to use that conversation to talk to him about how the army could help. And the good news was we were able to extend this soldier in service past his run-out date to make sure that he was still getting paid as a regular soldier while the investigations were going on. Thankfully, the condition he had was much more benign than we at first feared. He's now fully fit again. He's made the transition from regular to reserve service, and he's still serving with me. But I think what that did, despite the fact that he and I knew one another reasonably well, I think the ability to have that tough conversation, but then also the ability to try to help and come up with something really practical, I think that was something that will remain with me for a long time as that responsibility for leadership, but also some of that empowered ability to make a difference to somebody's life.
And your ability and insight to be able to do that, and the compassion and empathy, ability to have those difficult conversations in a way that leads to outcomes that were good for the soldier in this instance, do you think that's a skill that you've always had, or was it something that developed through practice and experience of leading smaller teams?
It's almost certainly a combination of the two, I think. There might be some innate empathy that I hold, but I'm very much a believer that you develop your innate skills through practice and those reps and sets. And I think, therefore, I almost certainly couldn't have done that as an 18 and a half year old second lieutenant, but as a 44 year old lieutenant colonel, I developed the skills and honed that innate ability over time in order to get the outcome.
And is that skill set something that you train down to younger officers that are under your command or younger non-commissioned officers?
That's a really good question, Ash. And I'm not entirely certain I know. You'd probably need to ask them. I would always hope that I would model that good behaviour and set the right example. And I don't think it's something that I have directly used as a lesson, but I'm confident that those people who are around me and supporting me, the regimental sergeant major, the adjutant, as we were dealing with this particular instance, I hope they will have internalized that and they'll see that as a skill they can take forward in the same way that I learned from my commanding officer when I was an adjutant, for example.
One of the very significant operations that you've been doing since being in command of Phalanx is Operation Interflex. Can you explain what that is for people that don't understand and what your role was in doing that? Because as a reservist regiment, there were some specific challenges that were different to if a regular battalion had been doing it.
Operation Interflex was conceived in June 2022 as a response to the Russian offensive into Ukraine in February of that year. And it was an undertaking by the army to train recruits for the armed forces of Ukraine. There's now 11, maybe now 12 international partners with the Brits who are putting Ukrainian recruits through a 5-week training package here in the UK. That's commanded in Aldershot by a colonel. And when I was on task in the latter half of 2023, we had 4 battalion headquarters spread across the United Kingdom. And every few days, perhaps every 48 hours, a flight would come in from Eastern Europe, bringing more recruits in. We would put them through a fairly rudimentary, very hasty training program to get civilians to a point where they could operate basic infantry skills in a very short space of time, so they could then go back to Ukraine. And those recruits, when they went back to Ukraine, they would go to one of 3 destinations. They would either do specialist training, so they would train to be an engineer or a sniper or a medic. They would go to a unit that was out of the line and would conduct collective training, embedding alongside a unit so they could then fight collectively. Or in some rare cases, they would get pushed into a unit that was in the fight as a battlefield casualty replacement. So my role in that, I did 2 things. So initially, my headquarters formed with mobilized reservists, and we mobilized about 180 reservists from across the field army to act as trainers for the Ukrainian recruits coming through. So that was from about March 2023 till July. Then from July onwards, we took over 2 sites, one in Kent and one on Salisbury Plain, and we ran training with up to about 900 Ukrainian recruits on site at any one time. And in addition to having British trainers as part of that task, I also had to integrate training teams from Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and Lithuania.
The reservists that you mobilised, were they all from the infantry? Were they all from the Duke of Lancaster's regiment?
Far from it. So we mobilised about 180 personnel, 18 different cap badges and 22 different units. Because of the skill sets we needed, the overwhelming majority were infantry soldiers and officers, but we also had soldiers and officers from yeomanry regiments, Royal Logistics Corps, we had Royal Army Medical Corps cap badged, a huge variety of people, Royal Signals, and that was a real strength. One of the advantages of doing Interflex from a reservist point of view was it supercharged our ability to get people instructional qualifications. So given that we needed people to be able to run skill at arms lessons, we needed them to be able to run live firing on the range, well, that meant we had to get these reservists those qualifications in the first place. So we sent nearly 80 people down to Brecon on a series of bespoke courses that were run in spring 2023, and they came away with nearly 120 separate qualifications, which allowed them to deliver on the operation. But more importantly, I think for the Army Reserve, they then take those qualifications back into their reserve units. And you've then got more reservists who are able to train themselves as skill at arms instructors or range conducting officers.
Did you have any particular cultural barriers to overcome in integrating those multinational trainers, but also within that multi-cap badge organisation from the British Army Reserve, because it's quite a tribal organisation.
So to look at the challenge of integrating so many reservists from disparate units first, it was a challenge. We tried to minimise the impact. So we had soldiers, for example, from 6 and 7 Scots. We knew they were going to be operating with 4 Scots, so we tried to keep them together. So they might come from different battalions of the Royal Regiment of Scotland, but at least they were together. The other thing I encouraged the two reserve subunit commanders to do was to look at how they could generate something that created identity for their training teams. And in my regiment, certainly in our regular battalions, we often use battle honours for the names of companies rather than just ABCD headquarters. So I encouraged the company commanders to look at that, to consult their people, to try to come up with something. And it could have been a battle honour that all of their component cap badges shared. But actually what they ended up doing in the long term is they tried to come up with something that had resonance with the Ukrainians as well. So one of them became Trident Company, because that was something that we felt would have resonance with the Ukrainians they were training. And that seemed to work. I wouldn't overemphasize the challenge of trying to integrate people in that context, though, because the singular purpose that everybody felt, the value they believed was inherent in training Ukrainian Armed Forces recruits, actually, I think that sense of purpose overwhelmed any sort of petty tribal issues that we could have encountered. As far as integrating multinational elements goes, that was a slightly different problem. And I suppose I was lucky insofar as I had 3 Commonwealth nations, the Canadians, the Australians, and the New Zealanders under command, along with the Lithuanians. But the challenge was we were split across 2 different sites, one in Kent, one on Salisbury Plain. So bringing them together and understanding the cultural differences, even between Commonwealth armies, took a little bit of effort. And the key way I thought that I could get around that was by making sure I was setting the example within the leadership team. So I would make sure that if I possibly could, I would bring all the company commanders together, even though it involved a 3-hour drive from one site to the other, as frequently as I could. I would bring them together as my senior leadership team. And we didn't need to do very much necessarily. It could just be having a coffee and chewing the fat, or it could be taking part in a mission exploitation symposium or something like that. But just trying to create that sense of a single team from the top, I think then helped. I also encouraged the idea of instructor exchanges. So, for example, the Royal Canadian Engineers instructors would come across from Kent to Salisbury Plain. They'd sit alongside the New Zealanders and they would critique one another's lessons and vice versa. And we would then try to use that to pick up elements of good practice that each was doing. But I also tried to encourage a gloves-off approach. And I was really grateful to the New Zealand company 2IC who wrote the first report. And he said essentially, well, the Canadians are really good at this. And we should be looking to emulate this because we're not so good. But this other subject, actually, we think we're quite a lot better than them. And we think there's something they can learn from us. So it was a warts and all approach. And it took a degree of humility on the part of all of the partner nations. But as a consequence, I think the whole was greater than the sum of the parts.
So that unity of purpose and creating a sense of shared identity was a way of overcoming those barriers of humility and making sure that people were open to critique and being willing to learn from each other.
I think that's right. When Interflex first started, Brigadier Justin Stenhouse, commanding the operation, he had humility as one of his core tenets for how the operation was going to run. So actually having the humility between the multinational partners in order to learn from one another was really valuable. Yet more valuable was humility when how we were dealing with Ukrainians. Some of the Ukrainians, some of their national support element and some of their officers have been fighting on and off for 7 to 8 years now, you know, since the annexation of Crimea in 2014. They've got a tremendous amount of operational experience, but they don't necessarily have the depth of doctrine and training experience that we have. So humility was critical to this. We had to demonstrate that we were humble enough to learn from their experiences, because none of our trainers had experience of the major combat ops that they'd experienced in Eastern Ukraine. But we also had to demonstrate to them that we were professional. We had an underpinning stratum of doctrine that allowed us to have that authority that we knew what we were talking about and we had the professionalism to carry it across. So that was a real challenge, but humility underpinned everything we did in that respect.
So within Interflex, you had people who had never been in combat, training some people who had never been in combat who were about to go into combat, but also working alongside Ukrainians who had a lot of combat experience, but maybe didn't have that doctrinal or training experience. How do you build credibility and authority for leaders who are leading people who've had combat experience?
So part of the challenge of credibility, I think, comes from mastery of your profession. So the subject matter expertise. It's also about your attitude, how you present yourself, you know, your punctuality, your turnout, all those little things that connote reliability and professionalism. I've seen multinational environments before where there can be a tendency to assume that because other nations' standards might not be as high as your own, you can afford to drop yours, and then you're in a race to the bottom. We were very clear that we needed to set the highest possible standards of professional conduct in the expectation that it was going to raise everybody else up. And I talked a little bit about humility as a way of approaching that, to accept that, yes, there are lots of ways in which we can learn from the armed forces of Ukraine with things like how they're using drones, how they're using fires, how they're using armored vehicles, their battlefield medicine. There's all sorts of things we can learn. But there are also things where we probably still do know best. And we needed to have the humility to pick our battles to understand where that would be. One example of that was one of my Australian team was having a real problem with some of the combat experienced Ukrainians, just when it came to talking about dealing with enemy wounded or dead in the aftermath of an attack. And there was one particular technique that seemed to be prevalent in eastern Ukraine, which from our way of thinking, both the Brits and the Aussies, this just looked a little bit foolish. It required significant personal strength on the part of the soldier. It required exposing themselves potentially to incoming fire. And it didn't give them as much protection as we thought would be needed if they followed our TTP.
TTPs, that's tactics, techniques, and procedures.
And the company commander had to be very, very careful in how he explained that and said, well, all right, just because it's worked once in combat doesn't necessarily mean it's always going to work. Here are the reasons why we think our procedures are better. Let's just have a try and then tell us what you think. So it was acknowledging the experience that somebody had had and then sort of pivoting and saying, well, have you considered doing it like this? And I think that was really important.
Colonel Ed, there's a lot more I'd love to ask you about, particularly Interflex, but I know we're going to do a couple more episodes further down the line about Interflex on the human advantage. And as we reflect on your leadership journey, from my perspective, I think as a leadership style, you seem to have quite a good ability to understand the people that you're working with. And just from speaking to you before the podcast, you seem very interested in people, which isn't something I can say about every commanding officer I've met. Do you think that there is a particular leadership style that defines your ability to lead?
I'm probably not the right person to ask. It's probably something that would be better sat in a 360-degree appraisal. I do think you're right that I have a very deep interest in people. I have a deep interest in culture and what makes people tick. And I think probably that helps with people-centric leadership. But I think there's probably a bit more to it than that. And I think it's probably more that my leadership is a patchwork of styles that I've acquired over time. And a lot of the time, I don't even necessarily know what I'm doing and why I'm doing. It's just something that works for me.
We like to finish the human advantage with three quickfire questions. So first of all, how do you like to relax?
Opportunities to relax have been few and far between recently. I think my ideal way to relax would probably be in a deck chair, just over the boundary rope, watching a cricket match in the sunshine somewhere.
Very good. Maybe in the Caribbean. Are there any particular books, movies, podcasts, or people that you've learned a particularly pertinent leadership lesson from?
Having described my leadership style as a patchwork quilt, I think that the thing for me has always been to try to read as broadly as I can and pick up things from as broad a range of sources as I can. I did find James Kerr's Legacy, which I know was very popular here at Cal for many years. I found that hugely persuasive. I thought that was really good. And I picked up elements of that into my own leadership. But there's all sorts of bits and pieces. I was reflecting on my way here today about Mike Hoare's book about commanding Number 5 Commando in the Congo in the early 1960s. And although there's lots about that campaign and about the mercenaries in the Congo that we would rightly find reprehensible today, some of the ways in which Hoare led his people still would have resonance today. So I think it's really important to understand how you can pick the really critical elements out from what otherwise could be something we would otherwise overlook.
And if you could now offer one piece of leadership advice to Second Lieutenant Ed Fraser coming out of Sandhurst, based on what you know now, what would it be?
I'd tell him to go and find a German dictionary and look up Verantwortungsfreudigkeit, which is one of those wonderful German compound words, but it describes a willingness and a joy to accept responsibility. So I think I'd tell myself to relax and enjoy it and accept that responsibility, because actually that's really what makes this whole thing worthwhile for me, that opportunity to take responsibility and that opportunity to be around the people that I've served with for so many years that makes it worth getting out of bed in the morning.
Colonel Ed Fraser, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Colonel Ed had a really good level of self-awareness about his leadership style and how it had developed over time. But it went right back to that early phase of having those two different training experiences before taking over platoon command, and the awareness of why competency, your ability to do your job from a technical perspective to a high level and really understanding your craft, needs to be paired with human understanding. So that's getting to know your people and what makes them tick. He knows the importance of identity and shared purpose by talking through what happened on Interflex and how creating an identity for the subunits connected to the purpose of training Ukrainian soldiers mattered in making the whole organization work together effectively. Within that, there's the example of being influential, which is gathering all of his commanders together so that he can ensure that that shared vision, shared identity, and shared purpose transmits down into the smaller units.
This was an episode of The Human Advantage from the Center for Army Leadership. It was produced and presented by Ash Bardwaj of Digital Dandy and co-produced and mixed by Hannah Varrell. What you hear on each episode are the views of the participants and do not represent the position of the Center for Army Leadership, the British Army, or the UK government. Please rate and subscribe to The Human Advantage on your podcast app, where you can find more episodes. If you enjoyed the episode, do send it to any friends and colleagues that you think might appreciate it, and maybe even share it on social media. For more information about developing leadership, just search online for the Center for Army Leadership. Thanks for listening.